Dorsey and Lloyd George appears to have thought that you could punish communities in order to isolate the gunmen and render them vulnerable to the Crown forces. So that is strategic terror. And the same can be found on the other side with campaigns against informers, so-called. If you can punish enough, if you have enough exemplary punishments of informers, others will be afraid to pass information to the Crown forces. So that is rational terror, in a sense. But there's also the irrational terror, which results from fear and ignorance. And of course, there's no clear line between the two kinds, where actually you don't know who the informers are. You don't know who in the community is sheltering your opponents. But you suspect that you know. And that's where the danger comes, that whole villages will be punished, which are not complicit in so-called rebellion, or whole classes, such as Protestants, for example, in a locality may be punished because they're thought to be prone to become informers, even if the evidence isn't there. And it's in those conditions where you're being attacked, you know that information is leaking, that your enterprises are being foiled on both sides, that you begin to have aberrant and increasingly brutal behavior, secret assassinations by so-called anti-Sinn Féin gangs, or off-duty police being shot in the back or killed in a pub, this sort of thing. In other words, there's a psychological element to it. It's not just the psychology of fear created by the terrorist, but the psychology of insecurity which gives rise to terrorism.
I mean, if we look at the counterinsurgency throughout the period up until 1923, I think, would it be fair to say that whereas the British effort is not very successful, both the Northern Ireland and the Free State counterinsurgency are pretty successful? Would you agree with that, first of all, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think the success of a reprisal strategy or extreme coercion against targeted groups really depends on the degree to which the government is regarded as legitimate by citizens. And so you have the provisional government and the new Free State government conducting the most dreadful reprisals, I mean, brutal and cynical reprisals against so-called irregulars and their supporters, but getting away with it without losing legitimacy because it's considered that there's something worthwhile to come out of it. In other words, the use of what in normal circumstances would be seen as intolerable force, often against either the guiltless or the not very guilty, is justified by the emergency and by the widespread belief that it's worth creating a democratic state, a majoritarian state in the South. Now, I think the same applied in Northern Ireland, because after all, the result of partition was to carve up the country into two states, each of which had a very large majority, which dominated politics for decades to come. So the northern state now wasn't nearly as brutal in its suppression, if you look at the number of executions, the number of arrests and internments, as the southern state in its early days. But it was brutal enough. It too could get away with it, even get away with the punishments administered to deviant unionists and loyalists, because of the massive popular and democratic support that it had acquired.
But in relation to something like the British Army, is there a case that once you let the genie out of the bottle in regards to repressions and reprisals, like as you've spoken there and you've written about Balbriggan, is it very hard then for an army to reinforce discipline within the ranks afterwards?
Yes, I think the result of the reprisals, there were two results. One was to make it extremely difficult to conduct any sort of policing operation. The army itself was held to be less undisciplined than the paramilitary police, the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. But undoubtedly, once these had occurred and had been condoned by superior officers in many cases, while not actually directed by any central authority, it makes it extremely difficult to get things together. Now, in the martial law zone, to some extent that was achieved in 1921. There was a distinct improvement in the performance of the Crown forces. But that was more than compensated for by the loss of legitimacy of the whole operation of the British government in Ireland. And I argue in my Balbriggan article that the result of reprisals like that was to convert non-republican nationalists into strong opponents of British rule, because the conduct of the Crown forces seemed to be worse than that of the Republicans. And I think that this is not simply a fiction created by Republican propaganda, although there was lots of that. It's also a fact that you have large numbers of houses, cottages being burnt down, people being attacked, one of the two big hosiery factories in Balbriggan being burnt to the ground with the loss of hundreds of jobs. All of this creates the feeling that you don't actually have a representative government at all, which is concerned with the welfare of Ireland. So my feeling is that the British government lost legitimacy over the period of the revolution by stages. And by 1921, they really had few supporters, even among so-called loyalists, and hence the strange phenomenon of peers and landlords sending articles to the reviews praising the superior performance of the Republicans compared with the so-called British government in Ireland, because at least they kept the streets clean and sent out patrols at night.
I think one of the most controversial things of all in the whole period is the question of sectarianism. It was controversial then, and it's controversial now still. One thesis that was raised by the late Peter Hart is that when the IRA looked for informers, they looked disproportionately for Protestants, and there's a good chapter in the book which says that in West Cork, that tended to be the case. What do you think of that argument?
I think that it's been somewhat overemphasized as part of Peter Hart's work. What he argued was that there were quite a number of groups which were identified by Republicans, particularly in Cork, which he studied most, as suspect, not merely Protestants, but also travellers, army deserters, any kind of stranger was regarded as a potential threat to the national polity. Now, there's undoubtedly an element of sectarianism in what was going on. He may have overemphasized it somewhat, but what he did pick up on, and what was one of the great novelties of his work, was just what devastating effects that could have when the lid was taken off, so to speak. In other words, his idea was that among many assumptions, deep buried most of the time, in the Irish Catholic mind, was that Protestants were really of a different stock, potentially anti-national, however much most of the time they would seem otherwise, and however well one might get on with them from day to day. And I think his study, particularly of the Dunmanway killings in April 1922, pointed to that, where you have a case where a dozen people were killed and all of them were Protestants. And the question is, why were they killed? He argued that there were all sorts of justifications which were put forward at the time. He argued, by the way, and documented this more fully than any of his adversaries, that many of them were believed to be informers, and that was a rationalization for killing them. Now, I think he probably went too far in emphasizing this sectarianism, because it's only in his broader story, it's just one of many fears and phobias that Republicans appear to have had about marginal or minority groups that weren't part of the community as they defined themselves.
Would it be fair also to say that this varies a lot from region to region in the War of Independence?
Well, undoubtedly. The kind of sectarian incidents that he described are not limited to Cork. But in every case, there is an ambiguity about the motives of those concerned. What he was talking about was much more the psychology of the killers than their conscious motivation. I doubt that any of these killings were done by people who said, "I'm going to kill that person because he or she is a Protestant." It's a question of what guided the deeper process of decision-making, and that's something we can always disagree about, and passionate disagreement will continue to occur on that very topic. But the important thing is to assemble the evidence there is, put forward the case, but also provide the evidence which can refute that case. And that's what Peter Hart did in his book, with the ironic result that many of the attacks on his work are largely based on documents that he assembled himself.
Obviously, the events in Cork continue to be very controversial for a number of reasons, but something which is not talked about that much, I think, in general discourse, is that in the north, I mean, Catholics have their own story where they suffered what they considered to be a pogrom. You had incidents like the McMahon killings where a family of six were targeted by what we think were off-duty policemen. So is that part of the story of terror in Ireland and sectarian terror?
Well, it undoubtedly is. But because this book is the work only of historians associated with Trinity, we had nobody to write about what was happening in the north. Now, there has been quite a lot of work done quite recently about this. And, of course, there's always the other side to the story. There's Alton of A, the killing of unprotected Protestants, as well as the McMahon murders. And Alan Parkinson, who's recently done a book on the British support for the anti-home rule movement for the war, he's also, I noticed in the paper the other day, argued that the term pogrom is unacceptable, that it's inapplicable to what was happening to Catholics in Belfast in 1920-22. That, in other words, there is not such a concerted movement as one would describe from Russian precedent as a pogrom. Rather, what you have are eruptions of violence in which paramilitaries on both sides are involved. But because of what we call the demographic balance in the Belfast area, Catholics tended to suffer worse. So they're one-third of the population, but two-thirds of the victims are Catholic. Now, that's something I would have liked to have had, an impartial dissection of that two-way movement of terror that occurred in Ulster.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our interview. Thank you very much, Professor Dave Fitzpatrick. The book is Terror in Ireland, 1916 to 1923, from the Trinity History Workshop, and that is published by Lilliput Press. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.